evening, everyone. Thank you, David, for the introduction. And it's an honor to be here. I hope that it's a useful evening for everyone who is in attendance. The health effects of hydro fracking are very poorly known. And well, I'll get into some of these this evening. I have a little agenda here. I'm going to talk a little bit about the precautionary principle. I'm going to do a very brief overview of toxicology. I'm going to study the chemicals used in hydrofracking, the products and individual ingredients, what comes out of the ground, which Tony alluded to already, and air contamination and spills, and some next steps. The precautionary principle is a moral and political principle that states that essentially that we should do no harm. That if an action or policy might cause severe or irreversible harm to the public or to the environment in the absence of a scientific consensus, that harm would not ensure. The burden of proof falls on those who advocate taking the action. This is a widely practiced principle in the EU. In fact, it has been adopted as law in many countries in the European Union. The difference is pretty rapid. For example, in the United States, there are approximately 10,000 individual chemicals used in health and beauty products and cosmetics. In the EU, 1,500 of those chemicals are banned from use for that purpose because they're considered unsafe or their health effects are unknown. In general, there are about 100,000 industrial chemicals in use in the United States these days. Only 15% have been any health studies done at all. And of those 15%, only a few hundred actually have had full toxicological studies done. So we're all swimming in a world of synthetic industrial chemicals. You've seen some of the studies that have been done recently of prenatal tests of unborn babies, where they did a panel of dozens of different industrial chemicals, and the babies' bodies were laced with these chemicals already unborn. I'm going to do a real quick overview of toxicology. I'm assuming that many people in the audience have, who are a medical profession, have some toxicological background. There are various routes of inhalation of hazardous chemicals, some which are important to know about. Inhalation is the most common one, of course, breathing something in that's around you. Ingestion means swallowing through drinking water or other things, absorption through the skin of eyes, and injection, which is very rare. Many hazardous materials can cause injury by any or all of the above routes, depends on the material. And once again, the dose makes the poison. Paracelsus, of course, of whom many people are very aware, developed this in the Middle Ages, basically. The original quote is, "All things are poison and nothing is wrong without poison, but only dose permits something not to be poisonous." And this is actually, the word "but" there is very, very important. There are some, will I repeat it?
Please.
Okay. "All things are poison and nothing is without poison. Only the dose permits something to not be poisonous." That's the original quote from Paracelsus. The word "but" there is because we are finding out that there are many, many chemicals whose health effects are even more severe at very, very low levels. And Dr. Law will be addressing that oral question of endocrine disruptors that will be coming up in the next presentation. The effects on the living system are of course something we need to know. Respiratory system is the most likely system to be involved because we're breathing in stuff. Everybody breathes in air, as Dr. Mbrapia pointed out. So there are lots of different side effects of hazardous materials from respiring those materials. And of course, the gastrointestinal tract is important as a way of ingesting contaminants from water in particular, but other sources, milk, I suppose. And of course, there are many systemic effects involving many organs going through the gastrointestinal tract, so lots of different things can happen there. Eyes and skin are, of course, pretty sensitive organs, and we all have lots of them. And well, only two eyes, so lots of skin coverage. Irritation, drying out, defatting the skin, etc., are common effects of hazardous materials on the skin. Acute toxicology is a single short exposure that usually has quick effects, and the effects are often reversible. and chronic toxicology, which are a big concern here tonight, due to the chronic effects, long-term effects of these materials, is repeated exposure, usually at very low doses. The effects are usually delayed, such as cancer or some other systemic disease, and the effects are usually irreversible, unfortunately. And there are many factors that affect our susceptibility to chemicals. Age, nutritional habits, physical condition, medical condition, drinking and smoking, of course, that kind of thing. And of course, in the duration of exposure and rate of exposure are very important as well. So this is a little teeny nutshell bit of toxicology there. Okay. Now, there are many different products used in hydrofracking. The New York State Draft Environmental Impact Statement suggests that there are about 207 products that have been proposed to use in New York State. And of these products, only 48 have a partial disclosure of their ingredients because the industry considers the ingredients to be trade secrets and competitive advantage. They are not telling one, except maybe the DEC, what's in there. TEDx, which is the Endocrine Disruption Exchange, which is a very well-respected organization that's been involved in the studying of the effects of hydrofrac processes and other aspects of the oil and gas industry for a long time now, lists 944 products used in fracking fluids nationally. And they have a very long, extensive list of hundreds of pages of hundreds of chemicals, basically, that go on forever, all their health effects, and the combinations of all these different chemicals and the various products that are used in the hydrofracking industry. So we have a very chemical-intensive industry here, and very high-hazard chemical-intensive industries as well. Most industrial processes are very hazardous. This is no exception. And of course, only a few products are actually used in any one fracking operation. They're not using 800 products or whatever. They're just using a few things. And each well tends to be engineered in a way that specific products are chosen for that particular well, given the geologic conditions at that point in the ground they're actually working on. This is from the draft, the environmental impact statement from the New York State DEC. You see here, it's just water. Oh, this is water, right? So water is this big chunk here, and sand, of course, some proppant. Other things are used as proppant. We're concerned about this 0.5% or whatever it is over here, which are the chemicals that are used. And so, it's 0.5%. But 0.5% of 5 million gallons, it's a big number. And it's a large quantity of different kinds of chemicals that are used specifically, as I said, for different drilling conditions and different processes within the operation. Most of these products, are kind of obscure sounding to someone who's a novice kind of person or a lay person. It's hard to tell, basically. An OptiClean looks like something you can clean your sunglasses with, maybe, And Alpha's a hell of a nice car. I had a good friend in college that had one, nice little sports car, but who knows what these things really are, unless you're in the industry, of course. Less than 1% of fracking fluid is what they call chemistry. So here we go with the figures I suggested before, 5,000 to 3,500 gallons of materials per frac, basically. A lot of chemicals. Many of these categories of the products are used for specific purposes. Proppants, of course, are the sand and other materials used to hold open the fractures that are made. Large quantities of acid are used in many situations. Let's go back a couple slides here. You notice in this odd-looking tanker truck here has what is a corrosive sign on it, DOT corrosive. It's probably a truck of hydrochloric acid, because large quantities of acid are often put down into these wells to help dissolve the carbonate material that are in there in very siliceous sediments, or like sandstones and things like that. You use hydrochloric acid to detect sand. So often there are stages in the cracking process, one of which is putting a whole bunch of acid down all at once to help clean the well out and pipes out and everything else. So back here again. And you see in this slide, gentleman here is carrying like a heavy bag, probably a 60-70-pound bag of one of the chemicals. A lot of these things come in bags and totes and tanks and are on site because they are needed for specific processes during the actual petrochemical. Okay. The chemicals used in hydrofracking are also fairly expensive. The SGIS lists 257 distinct chemical substances by family. TEDx lists right now 632 distinct chemicals that are used nationally in the fracking process. The thing I find sort of amusing is that the Pennsylvania DEP lists 80 chemicals as the only chemicals being used in Pennsylvania in fracking. I have a suspicion this isn't very accurate. It seems a little low, only 80 chemicals. Who knows? Compound-specific toxicity data are very limited for many chemical additives to fracturing fluids. This is direct from the DEIS once again. They just don't have a clue what a lot of this stuff does to the human body. And once again, the chemicals are grouped into categories based on health structure or function. The review was actually done by the Department of New York Department of Health, and it was a very cursory and generic survey of chemicals. They did not go into any in-depth study of the materials proposed at all in the draft environmental impact statement. I'm just going to go through a few examples of some of the more serious chemicals concern in the fracking fluids that are used. One of them, of course, is aromatic hydrocarbons, benzene in particular. We're not supposed to be using any diesel in fracking. Diesel fuel was used for a long time as a fracking fluid. We know for a fact it's still being used as a fracking fluid. And any of these higher petroleum products, refined petroleum products, diesel in particular, are going to have a certain amount of what is called the BTEX family. It's benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene, all of which are carcinogens and mutagens in various fashions. They're naturally occurring in the produced fluids from the well, and of course, as I mentioned, diesel that used in fractions, there are high concentrations in diesel exhaust. Dr. Rafia mentioned the tens of thousands of truck trips that would have to be taken to do a major operation in New York State, probably hundreds of thousands or millions of truck trips, actually, all of them spewing out diesel exhaust like mad. And of course, benzene is a known carcinogen. It causes leukemia, damage to the liver, central nervous system, and many other effects. Formaldehyde is widely used in a variety of fracking products. It's a gas at room temperature, but it's used in aqueous solution. Most of you are familiar with formaldehyde. It's in the bombing fluid in the movies or something like that. It's used in very low concentration, mostly as a biocide, but it's very toxic and dangerous even at low concentrations. Formaldehyde is actually one of the few industrial chemicals that is actually has its own OSHA standard because it's used so widely and has such a severe health impact. It has a 0.05 part per million action level, meaning above 0.05 parts per million in the air in the workplace, and the employer has to do something to protect the workers from being exposed to formaldehyde. So, I know they're pretty serious material. 1,4-dioxane is used in surfactants and other products. It causes damage to the central nervous system, liver, and kidneys. It's a problem with a carcinogen. Hydrochloric acid is used in large quantities in some fracking operations. Once again, it's a very strong acid, severely corrosive, strong irritant. Something like this chemical in particular, hydrochloric acid, is probably not much of a public health issue because it's used very locally. It's more of an issue for the workers on the pads and the people that live in the immediate area of the drilling pit. And then that would be in like a spill situation or something like that. But as we all know, spills happen. So, glutaraldehyde is used as a biocide in a number of different products. It is extremely toxic. It's one of the very few chemicals that has no adverse effect level. Meaning, even a few molecules in a living cell of glutaraldehyde are going to cause havoc. Its observable effects in mice are 0.02 parts per billion, which is a teeny little amount. Glutaraldehyde is commonly used in medical laboratories. So how many people here have a glutaraldehyde bath for sterilizing instruments in their laboratory? Anybody here? No? No, it's good. It's used as a 0.02 part percent disinfectant in medical laboratories. So it's a very, very dilute material. And then a few other things that are around, like methyl alcohol is used in large quantities. It's very toxic. Causes blindness in teeny little doses. It's what's used to denature ordinary methyl alcohol and make it undrinkable. 2-butoxydethanol is used in a wide variety of products. It's used as a solvent that's readily absorbed by the skin through inhalation. It's an irritant that the nervous system affects, suspect carcinogen, and it's a well-known endocrine disruptor as well. One of the biggest concerns is the biocides that are used. I mentioned a couple things already, like glutaraldehyde and formaldehyde in particular, but there are a wide variety of bromine-based biocides, some of which are incredibly toxic and severe irritants and so forth. One particular one, the BMDP compound, the third one now, is toxic to fish below levels of analytical detection. So, you know, even small amounts of this stuff in produced fluids from a well, getting into the environment, is going to be rather nasty. It's a suspect carcinogen used to break down, it breaks down to form formaldehyde and nitrosamines in animals. And both formaldehyde and nitrosamines are known carcinogens. And it goes on and on. The list goes on for page after page. I mean, there are many innocuous substances used, but there are also many extremely nasty substances used as well. What comes back down once again? Steve's going to give an overview of the groundwater issues, so I'm just going to do some of the chemical stuff until we get. We are told between 9 and 35% of the water coming out of the fluid coming out of the well is going to be laced with all different sorts of chemicals coming out of the ground once again. This is, you know, hundreds of thousands to millions of gallons per well overall. It's often held on site in storage ponds or pits. And it's supposed to, what really should be done, should be treated at specialized industrial wastewater treatment plants. Also, most of this stuff that was regulated, if it was regulated by the federal government under the Resource Reclamation Act, which is the Hazardous Waste Act, it would probably be deemed to be hazardous waste and would have to go to an industrial hazardous waste treatment plant, technically, probably. Now, there are many different parameters detected in both Pennsylvania and West Virginia wells that have been dug recently. This is, as Dr. Andrade mentioned, lots and lots of salts. Dissolved chlorides, all different kinds, suspended solids, mineral scales, friction reducers, acid gases. Specific substances, once again, include the BTX, benzene, toluene, etc. Many of these things are naturally occurring hydrocarbons that are already in the shale coming up with the produced water. Trihalal methanes were not in the fracking fluids initially, but they formed underground. What you have happening in these wells is you have all these different chemicals that are in the fracking fluid. You have hundreds of individual substances, probably thousands of individual chemical substances in the shale already. It's at great pressure underground. It's 150 degrees. And it's like this chemical cauldron, basically. If you're a synthetic organic chemist, you can imagine what would happen in those conditions. Hundreds of new compounds are being created underground in the fracking process that didn't go in the ground, they were coming back out of the ground. Some of the things coming out of the ground are really nasty. There's a lot of heavy metals, of course. All these are regulated substances in an ordinary industrial environment. They're not in the hydrofracking environment because of the so-called Cheney loophole where the gas companies and oil companies were deregulated in effect. But one thing that's really weird is this 4-nitrochromamine-1-oxide, which is found in pullback water, not in the fracking fluids themselves. Even the DEIS goes on this long rant about this stuff and where it came from and how it could be there. It's produced somehow underground in the process. And it's a thing that's in fairly high concentrations considering how weird it is. And it's used to, in a laboratory, it's used to induce chemicals synthetically in the laboratory, to induce cancer, rather, in animals in the laboratory. So it's pretty nasty stuff. One thing that's important that we need to talk about here is norm. The Marcellus formation is naturally high in normally occurring radioactive materials, naturally occurring radioactive materials. And this is from radium, uranium, that were concentrated during the actual formation of the shale itself. And so they're naturally occurring products. And they degrade into other different radioactive ions and isotopes. Radon daughters in particular, of course, are one of the more serious effects because radon's a gas and comes up through the soil into our homes and so forth in certain parts of the country. So the radioactivity level in many fullback fluids is many times higher than allowable for discharge in the environment. The GIS notes that There have been 13 test wells in the Marcellus Shale dug in New York State so far, and all 13 of those wells have produced fluids that were well above the acceptable background radiation levels for the public. So this is a very serious problem. I got a kick out of this quote. "We may need to regulatory oversight to ensure adequate protection of workers, the general public, and the environment." May need. This is from the DEI, the ICD. Friends in Albany. So, you know, we have to look at the discharge limits available, and we're seriously hoping that the DEC people are looking at the radioactivity issues as well. Air contaminants, once again, I think is really the most serious problem. Most of what we're going to get is exposure to the public. It's going to be through the air, not at a well site. They're not going to be involved in spills and fires and things at the well site, but they're going to be breathing in everything that's all swirling around, depending on whether the location is a relationship to various different operations, be it a drill pad, a compressor station, whatever it might be. Dust is a problem, of course. Noise is a really big problem in these areas. People are doing studies now of ultra-low frequency noise and its impact on human health. It apparently produces all sorts of really, really serious, very difficult to treat medical conditions. And Tony already mentioned methane, I'm not going to go through that. Carbon monoxide, of course, could be involved. Hydrogen sulfide occurs in some areas of the formation. Nitrogen oxides are a criteria pollutant regulated by the EPA. Nitrogen oxides come from diesel, primarily. And the combination of fossil fuels and methane in the air, diesel, the exhaust from diesel engines, flaring operations, all this kind of stuff, all contributes to the formation of ground-level ozone. Ground-level ozone is a really bad thing. It's what we call smog in Los Angeles. It has very serious health implications, especially respiratory problems, heart conditions, lung damage, all that kind of stuff. So it forms, you know, especially in intense pollution, guys, you get a temperature diversion that traps ground-level pollutants, your ozone levels can spike. And anybody who has asthma or other medical conditions is going to be in trouble. The EPA proposes to reduce the 8-hour primary standard designed to protect public health to 0.06 to 0.07 parts per million. So a little teeny part per million is going to be the upper limit. And of course, ozone can cause serious economic damage to plants and subsequent economic losses. There are many studies that have been done on the effect of ozones on plants, and one source that I had listed, basically, almost everything we like to grow around here as a plant that would be affected by ozone. Alfalfa in particular is apparently very severely impacted. There are lots of organic farms in upstate and central New York, all of which raise alfalfa to feed to their organic cattle, and that's not going to go over very well if their alfalfa's dead. I'm almost finished here. I just have a couple more slides. Particulate matter, especially from diesel flaring and so forth, is going to be an issue. Sulfur dioxide. There are lots of other air pollutants, standard air pollutants. Spills, of course, as I mentioned before, are always going to happen in an industrial environment. People are careless, they're tired, they're under pressure to produce, they make mistakes, and they spill things. And stuff breaks, equipment breaks. You know, valves can only go through so many cycles of being turned on and off before parts wear out and things break and leak. So, you know, this little slide, can't see this very well. Oops. Right there is that red thing, red kind of silver thing, was a tanker truck full of hydrofluoric acid that broke in two on an interstate highway in Pennsylvania. And the emergency responders that first came to it thought it was hydrochloric acid. And they treated it as a hydrochloric acid spill, which is the wrong thing to do if it's hydrochloric acid. You need to take a whole different procedure. Fortunately, none of them were very seriously injured. They had some inhalation stuff. And it took them a long time to clean the spill up, and they had to close the freeway, et cetera. And none of our local emergency responders are really prepared to handle spill situations from wells. That's a real serious issue right there. Almost all of them are volunteers in New York State. Very few of them have the higher levels of certification as hazardous materials technicians and stuff that need to really adequately respond to a spill. And it's kind of going to be a rough duty for those folks, too. So there are a few things you can do, many of which we're doing right here tonight. You want to educate yourself on the issues involved. If you're a landowner or you have a lease with a property with a lease on, you can do whatever you can do to see that whatever gas drilling is done in an environmentally friendly way as possible, assuming that's possible at all. You want to address your concerns to the DEP or the DEC, in which state you're in. Write your local elected officials, write letters to newspapers, form coalitions, et cetera, reduce your energy consumption. And Tompkins County, Sustainable Tompkins, the organization which I am part of, has a thing called the Finger Lakes or My Shovels Challenge, in which we challenge people to reduce their energy consumption, to show the big gas companies that we're serious about not wanting tons more gas than we have already. Thank you very much.
So I just, can correct me if I'm wrong, but a couple words there I'm worried that some people in the audience may not understand. Biocides, and so they're added to the fracking field to prevent microbial growth, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and so they're sort of naturally toxic. And then flaring is right after a frack job, they'll burn what's coming out of the well, is that correct?
Right.
And that can, of course, create a tremendous mix of both fracking fluids and aerosol and other things. So our next speaker, I think we set some really great groundwork here. Our next speaker is going to focus specifically on concerns as a practicing medical doctor. And he's Adam Law. While Cornell Medical College, Dr. Adam Law is currently a clinical assistant professor of medicine and specializes in internal medicine, endocrinology, metabolic medicine, and diabetes in private practice. Dr. Law received his medical degree and doctorate at the University of London and postdoctoral fellowships at the University of California, San Francisco, and Cornell. He speaks widely on threats to human health posed by environmental contamination associated with unconventional gas extraction, and the title of his talk is How Environmental Contamination Can Impact Human Health, the Endocrine System in Particular.